Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
For over 130 years, McCormick has helped you make mom's lasagna to keep her secret recipe alive. Take over taco night, no matter how chaotic your day is. Conquer the bake sale, even if you get to it last minute. And craft the perfect Sunday brunch when it's not even Sunday. Because with McCormick by your side, it's gonna be great.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Takecast. My name is Davis Matic. You guys can find me on Twitter, at Davis Matic. In this episode of the show, I am joined by, of course, my very good friend, Peter Overzet. The NFL season has reached its crescendo, so it was right about time to check in with Pete, see how he's doing, see how we are all feeling after the end of the season, and kind of get into the off-season discourse, all of the things that come up when we don't have fantasy football and the NFL to occupy our brains, NFTs, Twitter discourse, all of that good stuff. Of course, Pete is one of the best in the industry and always enjoy talking to him. So hope that you guys enjoy this. If you want to support the show, you can get bonus episodes on patreon.com/takecast, or you can just leave a rating or review on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. Let's go ahead and get into the episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Takecast, bringing, of course, in Mr. Overzet. We haven't done one of these post-season since Pete was, I think a celebrity out at the Super Bowl. You were one of the people walking the red carpet. You were next to, like, Timothy Chalamet leaving in your private jet right after the game. That was one of my favorite Super Bowl things was the people showing the private jet tracking of everyone leaving Los Angeles on Sunday night. Like that was enjoyable.
No, that was not me. I got to the airport incredibly early, flying economy with JetBlue. So yeah, no, you know, Underdog I think had a good year, but not enough to fly me first class out to the Super Bowl.
Man of the people, Peter, very unlike Jack Settleman, who just like goes to what most people in the Midwest assume is a giant city, which it is. Cleveland is a big city, and Settleman is sending these tweets like small town America, really, really getting in the heart of it. And I'm just dying. I'm like someone from a town of 7,000 people in Ohio is reading this, and it's like Settleman's such an asshole.
Well, no, the best part of that is that he went on Club Top Shot, and he's like, actually, there was hardly any restaurant options. He's like, there's only four good ones. It's like he immediately turned on the city. He's like, this is the best place I've ever lived. Then he went to the three best spots and was like, actually, this kind of sucks.
I'm done. I'm out. Yeah, no, it's an interesting time for us to be doing a show, obviously, as geopolitical global tensions are rising out there, and you know, our biggest concerns are illiquid JPEGs and how they are reacting to it, which we're so far down the fucking rabbit hole of you know where millennial people like us are at in terms of wealth, when like I'm checking my looks rare tokens this morning and like, oh, I wonder how they're doing, how they're holding up through all of this tension. Like, it's such a joke.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, it's the classic thing where, you know, this huge, you know, global event is happening. I think most people understand the gravitas of the situation and want to, you know, understand what's going on, you know, whether that's sending thoughts and prayers, whether however that kind of manifests. And yet we're still fucking humans that ultimately care about how it relates to us and what's going on in our life. And I think that's always such a mind fuck, right? Too. Like sometimes I see these tweets from people and they're like, thoughts go out to Ukraine. And it's like, you're just saying this because you want to get back to tweeting about what you want to tweet about. And you feel like you need to get this off to basically give you permission to start talking again.
You want to send one tweet
about Vladimir Putin and Ukraine so that you can get back to tweeting fantasy football stats on February 24th, like, obviously.
Yeah, I saw it. It does seem, I know DraftCheat called it out on Twitter yesterday, but it does seem like the fantasy football discourse, and even myself, like drafting best ball teams, I was not drafting best ball teams, or at least even at the clip I am now, last year at this time. I was like, I'll wait till the NFL draft and then I'll dive in. And it just feels like, for whatever reason, I don't know if it's content driven, boredom driven, but it's like all of us are just frothy to talk about fantasy football way earlier than I ever remember.
Oh, I mean, it's underdog driven, right? I think the massive marketing push that they have done is leading it. You know, certainly I think Bimeford and like just Roto-Grinders in general, and so much of the general conversation about fantasy football has turned to best ball now. Like I think like the average conversation about fantasy football now is about best ball and roster construction and, you know, should you do this? And like, and we're immediately starting to do the postmortem of the 2021 data already and being like, well, actually when you took Josh Allen, you should only take one other quarterback, or maybe you should have actually taken three, and which I think is fine. I don't know. And I mean, you don't care about this, but there's no baseball right now. So some of the people who would maybe be grinding like high stakes baseball drafts are not doing that because the season might not happen or might be shortened again, might get all fucked up. So I think that plays into it a little bit too.
No, I agree with that. And I was thinking back to, I mean, and I saw someone reference on Twitter the other day, it was like the great, you know, wide receiver hype battles of like 2014-15. And that was when I was just starting to make content. But it seemed like the conversations back then were much more centered around dynasty at this time of the year.
Oh,
and like,
big time.
To your point with underdog, and of course to pump my own bags, but I do think just because the drafting experience is so fun and slick on their app that it has just kind of pulled that conversation, where it's like, who knows, maybe if my fantasy league or whoever had like this killer dynasty app that we all just loved being on, like maybe the conversation would be more centered around dynasty. But it's just like, this is the funnest place to play. It's like still the same reason people are talking about Top Shot, even when they're over flooding the market and there's all these issues, but it's like, well, it's still kind of like a fun UI to like hop in the queue and rip open a pack. And so like, this is what we're going to do with our time right now.
Yeah. I mean, well, and dynasty fantasy football is just so much more labor intensive, right? Like you gotta even in these best ball leagues that we play in, it is just so much more labor intensive because you have to do trades, you got to do the rookie draft, you got to cut guys. The trading stuff is like the amount of time I would spend on one dynasty fantasy football trade with like an expected value of that time of like cents is, you know, it's like I could knock out five best ball mania drafts in the time it takes me to like complete a trade with Michael Leone.
Yeah, you have to, like, I will always, you know, my hometown dynasty league, I fire it up every year and it's fun. And I like having that one league where you do the transactions and it feels comfortable. But like outside of that, it's like, if it's not best ball dynasty, I'm just not doing it. Because like you said, it's just, I would do probably a really high stakes dynasty league that actually made me be invested in it, but it is really hard. Like I'm in some of these leagues that are a $40 buy-in, and it's not even like buy-in shaming. It's just like getting your interest levels up to really grind those edges. It's just hard to do because it is a huge time investment. And if it was like, maybe I should do like an FFPC dynasty league or something just where I feel like my grinding might be rewarded.
Well, so Leone and I co-own a $1,200 team. And the problem you find with that, not that that one isn't so much like an energy thing or anyways, it's that the way those people play, they overvalue the running back so much. So of course, Leone and I have this team with like, we have Jalen Hurts and Joe Burrow and all these wide receivers. You know, we have, I don't even know, I think we have like Metcalf and Ridley and someone else really good, like more wide receivers than we can even start. And we traded our only starting running back, Chris Carson, at the beginning of the season. We had no running backs, right? Obviously we have no running backs, and someone offered us Mark Andrews for him. So like, you have to do that trade, right? But we literally have no running backs. Like we have this whole, we have Kittle and Mark Andrews and tight end premium. Like, and this is like fantasy douche, no one cares. But the point is that at some point we're gonna have this great theoretical roster that we pay $1,200 for every year, or eventually we're gonna have to do a terrible value trade for a running back. Like, we'll have to trade a first round pick for, you know, Ezekiel Elliott or someone useless just to get some running back points. So that's the problem with the FFPC leagues.
Yeah, no, and it goes both ways too, right? Because I'm in one of those super flex, tight end premium, dynasty quarantine leagues that we started with Leone and Co. And I was pissed off about the group me. I deleted that app off my phone, so I'm not even in the group communications. And then I never even checked it. So sometimes it swings too far in the other direction with best ball, where now I just associate best ball with completely hands off. And in that league, you actually do want to still kind of make some long-term moves. But man, I mean, I don't know how you feel, but like basically how I viewed all my managed leagues, I'd have like a bookmark folder on my computer, and it just felt like a chore. It was like, okay, open up the bookmark folder with all of these leagues. And it's like, yeah, I want to knock off the high stakes leagues here first. And then you're getting down to these $40 dynasty leagues or $100 best ball leagues. And it's like, I don't have the energy for this right now.
No, I mean, that's the exact same way that I do it. I mean, I have a folder and they're all, you know, listed in order. And every once in a while for the dynasty teams, I'll go through all of them. I have, you know, Scott Fish is going to hate me for this, but I have abandoned some of them this off season. I'm just like, I paid for them. So I paid for this year and I was like, just give it to somebody else. Like our buddy John Bosch, who does the Eliminator Leagues, he like sent an email for one of these group dynasty leagues he did, and I was like, look, I'll pay, but I'm not gonna be a good owner. I'm not gonna be responding to any of the trade emails. I'm not gonna be making waiver moves. Like, you just gotta replace me, and he did, which I think is a fine mental health step.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good take for everyone. I had someone drop out of my dynasty league. It's like there's no hard feelings. Like, once you're done being motivated to play, just drop out and make it better for everyone. It is a bummer that just the way dynasty kind of works, and similar to, I guess you could say, like peer-to-peer sports betting, where it's kind of ripe for collusion, because otherwise, how sick would it be? Like, I would love, like, if Underdog launched a best ball dynasty tournament.
Oh,
like that would be sick, and where we actually got some top heavy prize pools and it could have a longer time horizon. But I think the trading element, which is pretty much necessary for any kind of dynasty league, that's just so hard to, you know, make it provably fair.
I mean, it would be amazing if they launched like a 2-year best ball league or something with like added roster spots, like, and you wouldn't even have to do a rookie draft. I mean, maybe you could inside the software. That might, you know, that might be too much with like, but you could just Underdog could launch it, and the scoring accumulates for 2022 and 2023, and then it gets paid out. Then I imagine that's a very low rake atmosphere for them. So probably not something that they are really trying to go after, but I mean, I would play in that. Like, I would play in that league format for sure.
I would love to see the DFS bros on tilt with, you know, first you locked up your money for a year and I said nothing, and now you're locking up your money for 3 years.
I have not seen as much of the DFS hardo anti best ball stuff recently. Like, I remember like Ricky D had this tweet back in the day where he was like, he's like, imagine painstakingly crafting 150 lineups for hand for the Millie Maker, and then that process taking 4 months. That's literally what you're doing for Best Ball Mania. But I haven't seen one of those in a while.
Yeah, I think it's probably a combination of they just gave in because Best Ball Twitter became such a monstrosity.
I mean, it really became DFS Twitter.
But also, too, like, there's the discrepancy with all this stuff, right, is, and you know, whether it is best ball drafts or whether it's even Top Shot, like, we probably convince ourselves, or a cohort of people convince themselves, they have more of an edge than they actually do under just like the guise of entertainment. Like, drafting best ball teams is fun. Ripping packs is fun. And even when you devote a ton of time to it, like, we all know that your ROI on the time investment is not good. But neither is bird watching, right? Like, so it's like, if it brings you joy.
Yeah.
So I think that's the thing. It's like, you're getting mad about people talking about best ball draft. It's like, it's literally just a hobby. No one is saying this is the best place to park your money for the next year. People would just legitimately have fun and view it as a great distraction.
Yeah, like, I mean, if all you care about is like maximizing ROI, you should be playing like NBA double ups on Yahoo or something. I don't know. It's like you talk about this all the time on your streams. It's like, yeah, I wouldn't have to play the spy every weekend on DraftKings. I would go do the, you know, I would go max enter the $10 tournament on Yahoo or whatever, yeah, and grind out the guaranteed overlay, but it's just way more fun to not do that.
Yeah, totally. And I don't think they have to be mutually exclusive, right? Like, I think, sure, all of us in our group, you know, we're willing to have fun. We're willing to donk off some money to have fun, to bet, to gamble. And yet we also want to be smart, especially when we're scaling up our play, or you're max entering BBM, or you're playing in higher stakes single entry tournaments. Like, we're not rich enough to just donk it off there, but I think we can contain multitudes and switch back and forth between like, yeah, we want to get it in good, but we also want to have fun. And I think that's like a worthy, you know, goal to aim for most players.
Yeah. And like, also my brain is so broken via all of this stuff, like, you know, via playing DFS since I was like 18 and playing in all these fantasy leagues, that like, if a hobby doesn't have the ability to return any money, like if there is no element of speculation, it is way less fun, which is like, I don't know, that's definitely some hardcore brain broken thinking. And that is, I think that like applies to like society as a whole, because, you know, all the glorification of like hustle culture, which I fucking hate, but yeah, is like a really, it's like the same thing.
Dude, that's what I'm going through right now. And Lauren and I are going on a vacation a week from today, so I'm excited to decompress. But I'm also been, you know, just wrestling with that constantly, because I've been just kind of taking it much easier. Like, when you take all the DFS stuff I was doing off my plate, it was like, you know, 15 to 16 hours of work, just right there alone, off my plate, maybe even more. And now it's like, you feel like you should be doing more, but it's also like you were going pedal to the metal for 7 or 8 months, and it's probably good to recharge. Yet we constantly feel this need of, like you said, the hustle culture. Oh, you're going to, you know, be left behind, or you're going to lose a step. And so I'm constantly wrestling with those two things.
Yeah. I mean, that's like a big work from home thing too. Regardless of if you're your own boss or if you are working from home for a company, like, there's probably always something you could be doing. There's probably always some work you could be getting ahead on. And those wires really get crossed when you work from home, because it's kind of hard to log off and leave. I guess one thing that is nice, and you probably have this too, is like, I don't do any work on my laptop at all. It's all on my desktop, and my office is on a separate floor than like the rest of our house. So like, when I do make that decision to be done, I don't like have to be like sitting in the living room, like looking at my computer, like, fuck, you should really get to some emails or whatever. Like, yeah. That's just it.
I'm the exact same way. I have my desktop. The only time I use my laptop is when I'm traveling. Like, I took it to LA and I was writing the newsletter and stuff like that from that. But otherwise, if I'm home, I'm doing work at my computer. And then when I'm away from it, I'm not doing work. I think the one nice thing is I've told you before, I've been going to a lot of the noontime gym classes at my boxing gym, and it just forces me to get up in the middle of the day. And yeah, he started those when the pandemic started. He used to not have the lunchtime classes, and I love it, because it just breaks up my day, gives me an excuse to get up from my computer. You exercise, and just also knowing I'm registered for the class, versus if I just said, oh, I'll go for a run at noon. Like, I'm never doing that. Like, I'm just going to blow right past it and stay at my desk. So it is that, just having things that force you to get up, because we have enough things going on. Like, I could go the rest of my life without ever being bored. I could be up the next 24 hours straight on my computer and have constant stimulus, constant things before I got bored. And so it's like, you really have to fight against that.
Yeah, no, that is a good, I mean, that's kind of like a semi-popular thing now, is like, you know, the value of being bored, the value of letting your mind not be stimulated. So I think I told you about this, but this wager that Justin Freeman and I made,
I saw I saw you guys talking about parameters, but I don't know if I heard about the finalized bet.
So it's all booked. Anyone, I mean, not anyone, obviously it would have to be someone we know since there's money involved, but it's a good idea if you're doing this. So basically we did, it's like fantasy sports for improving yourself. So it's like, it's very gamified. So there are point values for no liquid calories, point values for exercise, point values for steps, point values for fasting, negative point values for like cheat meals, eating out, making your bed, reading, meditating.
Making
like
your
that.
Bed, is it there?
Yeah. That's hilarious. What making your bed is one pointer, which I never used to do. Before we started doing this, I would just get up in the morning and just go. And I have to say, it is one of those things where it's like, all right, I started my day. I did it. I made the bed.
I'm a big make your bed guy. That's where I'm like a big straighten up guy, you know, it like if the pillows or, you know, whatever I like to go, it just like makes me feel accomplished. But yeah, you the mental health of just tidying things up goes a long way. Like a lot of times if I have a ton of work to do, I mentally can't get there until I straighten up the kitchen, throw in a load of laundry. And it's like, once all that clutter is taken care of, now my brain can work.
Also, I mean, it's a very real thing. The human brain craves order in general, which is funny because my desk is such a fucking mess right now. I'm actually looking at my desk right now and it's just like, what's the most half drank coffees you've ever had at your desk at one point?
I see, that goes back to me kind of being OCD with tidying up. Like I'll often come down in the morning and be like, oh yeah, you never put your coffee cup away from last night, but I'll never get to two. It'll always just be max one.
Dude, so it wasn't this week, but it was last week. And I wasn't even really that busy. I must have just been having a bad mental health week. Dude, I had five. So every day of the week,
every day.
Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, I had five coffee cups on my desk when I came down to Monday this week. And I was like, you are such an asshole. Like what you like, organize your life, dude, like get it together.
My OCD wouldn't let, I would be like, I have to clean these up before I can do anything on my computer.
Well, I sort of give myself a pass because my office is, it's like, we have like a half finished basement. So it's not like I'm the basement is just mine. It's not super organized down here. And so I'm just like, what does it fucking matter if I have a coffee cup or two, which is not, I mean, you know, it could all be organized down here. I could have a home, I could have a gym set up down here. Like it could all be good, but I'm just really lazy. What can you do?
Yeah, it's funny too. I was, and it's ironic that we're recording this right when I broke my streak, but since the end of the season, I had told you about this last year, I had a good stretch going where I left my phone at my computer at night. So you finish up a show, whatever, done watching TV with Lauren. It's just like, leave it down here. Just don't take it in the bedroom. And, you know, reading before bed, gotten a really good habit. But last night we get off ship chasing. And of course all the stuff with Putin invading Ukraine. And I was like, I need to go doom scroll upstairs. Like it was
like imagine not doom scrolling during I stayed up like an hour and a half past my bedtime last night, just hardcore doom scrolling.
Yeah. It was like almost impossible too. And you're kind of asking yourself, like for me, I'd been on streams for 3 hours straight. So I legitimately wanted to catch up on the news and hear what was going, but then there's diminishing returns when you're constantly refreshing. You're trying to see if there's a new video you're trying to see. And that's when you enter the doom scrolling portion. And then you notice that people are retweeting video game clips that aren't actually even missiles in being shot from Ukraine. And you're like, what the fuck am I even doing here? This is ridiculous.
Yeah, no, that was like COVID stuff too, right? The doom scrolling, like dooms, I feel like March and April 2020 is when doom scrolling as like a phrase entered into the lexicon. Like, people who are extremely online knew about doom scrolling, but like everyone was doom scrolling then, just like all the bad news, all the shitty stuff happening in China, the George Floyd stuff, the protests, like it was just nothing but bad all the time.
I know. And the thing though, is I think back to it and it's not even that different of even pre-internet for me. I remember, so in Colorado, my school was like 10 minutes away from when Columbine happened. And I was in sixth grade and my mom picked me up and took me home. And we did the Doom scrolling version of TV, in that we just like watched the Columbine coverage for like 10 hours straight, just like nonstop. They're regurgitating the same stuff, no information, but it's like, you're almost paralyzed to it when it feels so massive and hits so close to home that it's like, it's hard. And it's, how do you detach like getting information, staying informed with the diminishing returns of just watching that over and over?
Yeah, because it feels like it feels insensitive to like log off and go live your life. You know, you're like, well, that's not the human thing to do. Just pretend like it's not happening, and then you balance it at the same time with, well, what the fuck am I gonna do? Like, what is my role in the larger, just dynamics of like society? And you know, there, obviously it's nothing.
Everyone processes it differently, and some people process it by arguing the semantics of time person of the year for 12 hours straight on Twitter. Davis, that conversation broke me. Not even you, but I was just like, what, why, like, how is this important?
I felt that I did a good job of logging off during, and I was just like, well, if those guys want to argue amongst themselves, they can. I have noticed the no coiner brain broken people in my mentions have started to lose a disc. Like the no coiner people are having a tough time given all of the stuff that's happening in the world right now. I don't know if this is because I'm looking for it or if I just wasn't educated about stuff like this before, but the combination of the Canadian trucker stuff and the exchanges telling everyone, you know, get your money onto a coin wallet. And then, now all the politicians talking about basically cutting Russia off from like the banking pipeline of the world via SWIFT. It's like, I feel like financial, and like the problem that crypto was created to solve is like at the forefront more than ever. But maybe that's a wrong read just because I actually know what that stuff is now.
No, I definitely think that crypto stuff came to the forefront with the Canadian stuff, and even a lot of people who had hard anti-crypto takes have come around and posted stuff like, you know, I see the value in this so much more than I ever did now that it's in our face. But it's like, this shit has been happening in Venezuela. It's been happening in all kinds of places, but I don't know, because it wasn't right next door to us.
I found that very distasteful, actually. Like, there was some big right-wing blogger who did
that's the one I think I'm referencing. Yeah.
So he did some post about like, oh, maybe Bitcoin is actually good. And it's like, bro, people have literally been telling you that people are using Bitcoin in South America and in Africa for years. And like, you just didn't care. That's just very distasteful to me. And I mean, you know, the Bitcoiners, they like, cause I'm not one of those people either, but they're always like, check your financial privilege, bro. But that actually is one of the spots where it's like, maybe you should check your financial privilege a little bit, because it's a very real thing that's happening to literally millions of people in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. And like the Twitter stuff too, it you know, it's the same. The things like a viral tweet or a viral engagement thing, it's either like a blazing hot take or just something is a little bit off in the tweet, or something's just like slightly wrong, or it's like universally known that that's slightly wrong. But then like some of these conversations, it's like people are just arguing with you over literal semantics. Like they know that it's complete not good faith. They knew what point you're trying to make, but because they can get you with how you worded something, or because you didn't have a fucking footnote to your tweet. Like, I'm just like, what the fuck are you guys doing? Like, I mean, my brain just melts reading some of these back and forth on Twitter.
This is probably the most I have ever like hated being on Twitter in my life. Like the last, and honestly, I think a huge part of it is NFTs, because people hate NFTs as like a personality trait. That's like a guy online now. Like, you know how there are different types of like being online guy, like team record in bio guy, right? Guy who has Washington football team 8-8 in their bio, like types of guys. Like hating NFT guy is like a guy online now, which is just exhausting.
it almost is so binary at this point where it's like you either just gave in. And like every day I'll still see someone new. I was like, oh wow, you have an NFT as your profile picture. I didn't peg you as
NFT bro. Peg you. Yeah.
Or you just actually have to hate it. Like there's no just like I'm ambivalent to NFTs. I think they're great for the people who are doing them. Not my thing. Like that doesn't exist. You're either like all in or you fucking hate them.
No, and I have a hard time with this too. And I talked about this with Brian a couple times the last couple weeks of like, are we actually at a point in human history where it all does feel so extreme and more fractured or whatever? Or does this actually happen all the time? Is this how people felt in like depression era United States? Like did people back then feel like you know, the president is doing the right thing, he's not doing the right thing, it's this person's fault, and like I don't know, like I have a hard time with that. Like does it just feel so bad because we're in it right now, or is that just how humans have behaved historically?
Yeah, I think we're probably just whatever the object of our attention is changes, you know, with different generations, but like the way we feel it's probably as old as time. I bet like these patterns of behavior have been replicated over and over and over in different forms.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. So on NFTs, I mean, we're a year into it now, basically. I mean, we're Bales did his big victory lap on everyone and gave away at the moment. So I guess that does mark a year. Honestly, probably this is, I bet, actually, I know it was a year anniversary of my Tyler Herro sale because I think it was February 22nd, if memory serves. Got to be pretty close to when you did the CryptoPunk video, too.
Yeah, I'm trying to. That must have been. Yeah, because I think that was right before I went on my trip late March. So, yeah, I think it was probably mid-March last year. Yeah, it is wild. Coming up on these kind of milestones and being like, even when I was at the gym earlier, I was like, I remember being at the gym at this time last year and running over to my phone in between sets to see if I had a Top Shot sell notification. Yeah. And I was like, thank God I've moved past this kind of dependency. Like I can't even go to the gym for an hour without checking my phone. I mean, it was bad.
You don't check your phone at the gym?
Well, so I go to like classes and that's what makes it even worse. So like I was sneaking off like for water breaks and checking my phone where like the whole class is programmed. Yeah.
Oh, that is really good. So I mean, I have you had this experience where like obviously you like NFTs, you own NFTs, you mint them, whatever, but you find NFT Twitter to be very distasteful?
Yeah. I feel like I've experienced the entire range of emotions on NFTs, right? Like the financial highs, the financial lows, the community highs. Like you're in Club MGMI. We have a blast in there. It's a great group of
amazing
guys. But then you feel like the lows of it when prices are going down or there's infighting or whatever it is.
No, I love Club MGMI when the prices are down. Everyone knows when number goes down that I'm going to come in to Club MGMI and be like, yeah, boys, number's down, but we don't care.
Your timing is always perfect. And you're like, I'm big on like, I'll scroll up if I haven't been in the chat for a while to like gauge the sentiment. Davis just comes in guns a-blazing. I'm here, guys.
Yeah, no, never scroll up. I will say my time spent in Discords and things like that is basically done. Like I own the tokens I'm going to own. I don't think the last token I spent ETH on was months ago, was the Smiles token. But yeah, I just like, I like NFTs still, but I don't have the brain space. And I also am not one of these people that thinks that the profile pictures are like gonna change the world and are, you know, like the metaverse is very close. Though I think the more interesting use cases for NFTs are like going to be like entrance into gated communities, basically, which is what I think. I mean, a lot of people have had that idea. That's not a unique idea at all.
Yeah. I've been getting, and this isn't the first time anyone has made this comparison. And I think even we've made the comparison, but even just with what's going on in the world and seeing a lot of the NFT market really start to pull back, it's like, I've been preparing myself mentally for the like ICO bubble version of NFTs. And I even remember talking with Dangy and some of the NGMI guys when we were spinning up that Discord too. And I even remember when Topshot was pumping and I was doing like the non-ironic, not financial advice disclaimers, knowing like the music will stop at some point. And this will crash. And if you have not gotten your house in order or you have not mentally prepared for it, like you are going to be wrecked and you will be down bad in an unironic way. And I've just felt that creeping. And, you know, this isn't me calling bottom here or whatever, but I'm just saying the time will come. I don't know what it will be, but it's once you reach max euphoria, there is an opposite reaction to that. And I do feel with a lot of this stuff, like we're getting to that point.
I mean, I have firmly believed this and said this forever, that Bitcoin being even 30,000, Ethereum being 2,000, right? I mean, those prices cannot sustain in a multi-year bear market at all, right? The idea that Luna has this insane market cap, that these NFT projects are creating tokens out of nowhere that have liquidity behind them, like the idea that looks rare would have any liquidity behind it in a true bear market when the money printer stops is like there's going to be so many people left holding. I mean, I'm going to be left holding the bag at this point because I have all these tokens that are literally going to be worth $0. I mean, at some point, far be it for me to say when that point is going to be, what's going to lead us there. But yeah, I mean, it just feels as if the current overall crypto market is a total house of cards.
Right. And the one thing though, to not go full doom on it, is there is a kernel and there's a nugget within all of this that launched all of this that actually is very powerful and unique and will probably lead to lots more, groundbreaking technologies down the road. Like in the same way.
Oh, no doubt.
Like the ICOs were like this revelation of, oh, we can raise money and cut out, you know, being an accredited investor. Like that idea of raising money was like really powerful. And now we see even more mature versions of that with DAOs. And then NFTs take that same concept and like, oh, this idea of galvanizing communities and, you know, returning value to investors, like that is a cool idea. But now it's been so bastardized and so overrun by scammers and all of this stuff that it's like, we've kind of lost that nugget. And it does feel like we have to hit rock bottom for like the true, you know, people with good intentions to build like on these best ideas and not on the worst part of these ideas.
Yeah. You're not going to have all, but essentially all products in a market be, high value and be full of integrity when there are so many billions of dollars at play and anyone can get it. Right. I mean, like, De'Aaron Fox, the NBA player, just
saw that rugged his NFT.
He just rugged a bunch of people for like 700 ETH or something like that. And it's like, I mean, what are you going to do? Like, that's the NFT space.
I just saw that on Twitter for a half second today and wanted to look into that more because it's one thing for an Anon team to rug. Like, that's the whole point of being anonymous, right? Is you take the ETH and you bounce. Yeah. But we're talking about an extremely high profile individual with lots at stake, to where like, I'm talking like, the feds looking into like what happened to this, if this becomes a big enough story. So like, I need to look into it more. Maybe I'm blowing it out of proportion, but it looked pretty bad.
The optics of it were not good. You're right. I also don't know, but I mean, I just know the headline is De'Aaron Fox rugged a bunch of people and maybe that's true or maybe it's not. I do think though, again, this is the bad faith argumentative stuff where people are like, well, because Kim Kardashian was involved in some Ethereum offshoot rug, that means that all cryptocurrency is bad and that everyone involved in the space is bad and a rube or whatever. And it's like, you know, no one applies that logic to whatever they're in, right? So like a fantasy football writer wouldn't be like, oh, well, yeah, this one fantasy guy was a scammer or... who is that? Bobby Sylvester? Like, because one fantasy writer was like harassing women online. That means that all fantasy writers harass women online. And it's totally, I mean, it is just one of those things that the bad faith crypto people, they think that everyone in crypto, you know, behaves that way and everyone is out to scam. And it's very disheartening. But I don't know, maybe you share this or whatever, but like Twitter has always kind of been a drain, but it's like, it's the worst it's ever been right now. Like I genuinely don't like the app near as much as I used to.
Yes, I agree with you, but I think my relationship with Twitter is much more healthy.
Oh, way different. Yeah, no doubt.
I sometimes have to force myself of like, because basically now I'll just use Twitter to promote links to shows like when I'm live or the occasional joke. And I truly loathe having conversations on there. I'll have conversations with you in person. I'll have conversations on a show. Like anytime, like when I see, you know, we're all arguing about diversification in best ball, like I have thoughts on it, but I'm like, I'll just talk about it on a show. Like that's an actual forum where we can have conversations and stuff like that. I mean, Twitter is just the worst possible forum. Nothing is accomplished. Nuance, sarcasm, everything is lost. And it also, like the way our brains work is like when I post on Twitter, then you spend time reading the replies, refreshing the notifications.
Yeah.
It sucks you in. And so I've kind of swung in the other direction where I'm like, I know if I don't post, I won't go look at my notifications and that. And so I'm actually trying to balance it because like, yeah, obviously posting is good for business. It's good to driving traffic, all that stuff. But it's also like at what cost?
I mean, at the cost of your brain, right? Definitely.
Yeah.
Like, and it's not good.
It like, imagine like some of your, so like the, you know, using the diversification in best ball, I bet everyone from that who kind of weighed in on that could probably get on a round table on a podcast and have a pretty interesting conversation about that topic. Cause it is an interesting conversation. Take your like new time news article conversation. Imagine you guys getting on a show to talk about that thread. There's nothing to fucking talk about. Like people are just arguing for the sake of arguing. Like there's not even an interesting discussion there.
No, which comes down to the people don't like my politics. So they're going to argue with whatever political thing I have to say, which, you know, which is like, which sucks, right? Because like Brian and I don't hardly agree on anything.
Yeah.
Right. And we do these 2-hour podcasts where Brian's like, you're an idiot or not. But not even though Brian's like, this is what you maybe haven't thought about with your political philosophy. And then I'm like, no, I have thought about it and you're wrong because of X, Y, or Z. And like, again, Brian and I don't agree on anything, but we can talk for, well, we agree on the one thing that we both think is important, right? Which is like that. I think that's like a huge bridge, right? So Brian and I are both crypto people. And I think you can be a crypto person and be under that bridge and still agree because some people just don't think about money at all. Some people don't think about the state's relationship to money at all. I guess that's really what it's come down to, which is interesting. Let's talk about best ball diversification because I didn't weigh in on that conversation at all. And so I have thoughts, but much like you, I was like, I'm not going to jump in to Hayden and Bimefor's 87th tweet about the matter, you know? So I will, floor is yours. What were your diversification thoughts during that?
Yeah, I did talk about it a little bit on a episode with Splash Play, but yeah, my thought on it is, my macro thought is we're constantly looking for edges in best ball, same way in DFS. And there's different levers you can pull for, you know, an edge. And we talk about like Showdown, I feel like is a good example. Cause it's like, you can leave salary on the table. That's a way to pull a lever. You can roster the third string tight end that no one's going to play. That's a way to pull a lever. You can onslaught the underdog team. That's a way to pull a lever. So the same thing happens in best ball, right? Where structure going zero RB, that's a lever we can pull. Drafting a really unique guy in the 18th round that most of the field's not going to have, that's a lever. And then another lever is being overweight on a player you think is undervalued. But that presupposes that you're able to find players
to
consistently that are undervalued. And if your thesis is the underdog ADP is pretty efficient, which I am of the belief it is, I think it would be very rare for me to find a guy that I think is mispriced by, let's say, 3 to 4 rounds in a way that would dictate, if I thought a guy was off by 3 to 4 rounds, I would want to be over 50% overweight on that guy. But I don't know if I can identify a spot last year where I thought a guy was off by 4 rounds. So to me, it's like, in a vacuum, I think not diversifying would be awesome, because then you're on all this stuff that everyone else isn't on. But right. I don't actually think that's possible with how efficient these markets are.
Well, it's one of those things where it's like, you, it's very easy to do with the results, right? So it's like, oh yeah, dude, if I would have just taken Cordarrelle Patterson on all these teams instead of taking, you know, Amari Rodgers or whoever, then I would have been made in the shade. I would have had a good ROI season. And it's just like, because we already overtrust our abilities to prognosticate. Like there is no way that taking like 40% of a guy in the 18th round can be good. Like, I don't care. Like, and obviously people would respond to that with, well, I took Darren Waller in the last round of all my leagues in 2018 and I'm a genius, or I took Cordarrelle Patterson or Randall Cobb his rookie year or whoever, you know, you respond with that. But if you're left with, I did this last year, Donovan Peoples-Jones was my highest drafted wide receiver. I got two spike weeks out of him. So we ended up being maybe a small win. I mean, but he didn't score any points in the playoffs at all. I think he might have even been hurt in the fantasy football playoffs or whatever. So a horrible pick. And it's like, well, what if Donovan Peoples-Jones was Cordarrelle Patterson? Like, no, I probably would have just been better off taking 40 different guys then instead of just taking a bunch of him.
Yeah. And well, like one really good example of it is kind of how I've been analyzing how I think in these early best ball drafts, and I see my confirmation display or bias on full display, because I don't have like full takes on all of these plays. Players right now, there's so much in flux, right? With free agency, with depth charts, with the draft, like so much can change. So some of these guys, I just don't have takes on. Some guys I do have takes on, and I just keep drafting those same guys. It's like, I have a Jerick McKinnon thesis and I have a take on him. So
Let's hear the Jerick McKinnon thesis. Oh,
well, my Jerick McKinnon thing is that I know he's a free agent. I think it's most likely he re-signs with the Chiefs. I think he's pretty valuable to the Chiefs. And I think there's a little bit of the Leonard Fournette-esque positive inertia from the previous year's playoffs and just being willing to bet against CEH. And I think he's really cheap, that I think he's one of the best kind of late round running back picks right now, and that the market isn't like properly accounting for how well he played down the stretch. But my point in this analogy is that I've been drafting way too much Jerick McKinnon relative to his odds. And it's not right. Because I think he's a smash. It's because there's confirmation bias. And he's one of the only guys I see that I actually have a strong take on,
that you feel good about either way, that you feel positively or negatively about.
Exactly. And so it's like, I'm indifferent on another guy who might be just as good of a probability bet, but just because I feel something or know something, it's the same thing of like back when I first started playing fantasy sports, I would scan waiver wire columns and I would be only looking for names of guys on my team. I would want to read about guys already on my team. I wasn't trying to learn, you know, where's the next edge, finding the uncover guy. I was like, tell me how great the guys I have on my team are.
Which is, I mean, yeah, that is a pretty dastardly thing. My thought would be, I actually think you would gain more of the lever points from getting really overweight on the close decisions in the early rounds, as opposed to like what Liam did, obviously, you know, taking what 75% Gabe Davis or whatever, and you know, good for him. I hope you enjoy your $1 million, bud. But for example, if you had taken a stance that Cooper Kupp was the right guy out of Robert Woods, Cooper Kupp, DJ Moore, and there was one other wide receiver who went right there in the first round, you were smashing, or at the fourth round. Or if every time Allen Robinson, Amari Cooper, there was another wide, I keep forgetting, but Keenan Allen. So yeah. It was Keenan Allen, Amari Cooper, Allen Robinson, and you said, you know what? I'm out. I'm just taking Keenan Allen every single time here. You're smashing, which obviously again is sort of unrealistic, because those picks are really important, and you ruin your season. If you had made the stance that Allen Robinson was the guy and you had 40% Allen Robinson, you're like locking in one of your worst fantasy years ever.
Right. I was just talking about this with Sean Siegel in Ben Gretsch on their Stealing Bananas podcast. But the way I was thinking about like diversification was, in a perfect world, in just like a self-contained 14-week league, or my, you know, bucket or pool in an underdog league, I'd actually like to be overweight on guys, because you're basically saying, I want to take this position, and I think over a 14-week time span, like, I'm going to be right more often than not, and I'll get to return the value on it. But we know the way these tournaments are structured, and with the advancing and how they all operate as single 1 week tournaments, that there is so much randomness and variance that I'd actually, in a perfect world, would like to have overweight exposures for weeks 1 through 14, and then jumble up and diversify my exposures for the playoff weeks. And it's like, and that's what's so weird in how you think about this, is because I almost think of them as two different things.
That is, I mean, that is very true. And that is one of the reasons why I would love, and I don't know if they would do this or not, but I brought it up to Josh, but I would love if Underdog did, you know, the classic Best Ball Mania 3 or whatever, and then they also did a cumulative points championship. Like, it could be smaller, could be $5, you know, or a $25 with $100K at first instead of a million or whatever. But I would really enjoy the cumulative points format. I don't know. I mean, to me, that takes a little bit less randomness out of it, right? Where it's less about like, oh, you had to have this guy in week 17. And it was actually, no, you just had to have this guy. You had to have Cooper Kupp, right?
And the irony of that is all the people who push back against the super extreme hyper fragile draft strategies, whether that's zero RB or a true hyper fragile build, they would greatly benefit from that kind of format. Because it is the teams that are really pushing the edges to get really unique. So you actually give yourself a chance to win in week 17, when you not only need to make it there, but be different enough from the other 180 teams, or however much it ends up being, that you give yourself a shot at first. Because it's not only just drafting the right players, but then you actually need to have uniqueness and leverage to take down the whole tournament, which then goes back to these really unique builds, which case it's like, if you don't like that style, I mean, you would love cumulative points, or you would love playing self-contained 12-man leagues. That's where you can realize that edge more.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. And I mean, we are, well, where do you see the zero running back? What's even the right at this stage? The discourse. Where do you see the discourse headed this offseason? Honestly, I don't even know the team that Liam won with. I don't know if it was a four running back team or a zero running back team or whatever.
I think it was a hyper fragile. He had Jonathan Taylor, he had Aaron Jones on it, and I think a third guy, Damian Harris, he had in the mid range too.
Oh, Norris loved that, I bet.
To answer your question, it's going to be the same fucking movie we watch every year. Like, nothing will change. We will argue about this. And at the end of draft season, you know, Hayden and Leone and those guys will go look at the data and they'll be like, well, still don't have a big enough sample size of zero RB teams to actually know. Like, people will fucking talk about it all off season and still not actually draft true zero RB teams. So whatever, it's business as fucking usual.
Are you going to be drafting true zero RB teams?
Oh yeah, for sure. I do legitimately think, I mean, I'm biased because I've had back-to-back top 10 finishes in underdog tournaments with true zero RB teams. I still think it's the path of least resistance for not sacrificing a ton of projected points, getting unique rosters. The team I'm for, and I had in week 17, I was just talking with Gretchen Siegel. Didn't have Mark Andrews, didn't have Jonathan Taylor, didn't have Debo Samuel, didn't have Cooper Kupp. Like, literally every league winner didn't have Josh Allen. Like, not one of the top five or six most owned guys. And it was all there just because it had a unique structure. And so I might even lean into it heavier this year just because so many of the other edges are evaporating. I mean, how many teams are going to be drafted as anchor or two running back starts this year? I mean,
two running back starts and then not taking another one until the ninth round or whatever.
Like, that's going to be what, 60% of people's drafts?
It's probably going to be 100% of mine. Not going to be able to help myself. And the extra two rounds, I mean, one of those extra rounds is a quarterback, right? But then the other slot is probably for running backs in terms of the typical, like, it's probably going to be three quarterbacks, five or six running backs, 10 wide receivers, two or three tight ends. Like, that's what everyone's going to do now, but it'll be five running back instead of four running back is the hyper fragile.
Yeah, it will be interesting. I mean, you know, Herzig will probably run back hyper fragile and just tack on an extra wide receiver. The zero RB bros can tack on an extra running back dart. I will say, just from a time investment standpoint, man, I feel those extra two rounds. Like, I miss the 18 round. Like, the 18 round, like, we were popping off some of those in 40 minutes, and adding the two rounds, I don't know. Maybe it's just because I don't have takes on all the late players right now, but the extra two rounds feel like a chore.
You just taking Sky Moore there every time?
God, this Sky Moore bit is already out of control. He might actually be good though, right?
Yeah, he might be. I just was talking about him with Corain yesterday. A little bit of you know, Janice vibes or whatever. Oh, you know, they're true story. Jeff Janice sent me a DM yesterday.
No way.
Yeah, he did.
Unsolicited.
Unsolicited. He wanted me to do a layover of his official 40. Compared to, I will even tell you, I will, Jeff, if you're listening, I'm sorry, I'm opening our DMs right now, comparing his 40 yard dash to DK Metcalf, because he's faster. His 40 was faster than DK Metcalf.
That's crazy.
No idea where it came from, but I was like, you know what?
You ask him what he's up to these days?
Well, I know what he's up to, and it's not, he's like just a working man these days. Yeah. You know,
I still think people would enjoy what's Jeff Janis up to.
I bet he would do the show. He might not be a huge fan of my politics, though. I think he is. I think he is kind of a conservative guy. So he might not be super into it. But you never. He's been on the show once before. You never know. I'm hopefully having the gal on who identified the DAO hacker, the Ethereum DAO hacker from 2016.
No way.
So. I emailed her publicist and she said that they'll probably do it, but I'm very, if no one's read that book yet, The Cryptopians, that one's in the mail for me.
I have not read that one.
I mean, it just came out yesterday, so it's not even to my house yet, but
ooh, I need some books for my trip. This one looks like a fun one.
Oh yeah. But I mean, that is such an interesting story because that is exactly what Bitcoin people said would happen with Ethereum, which is that they would roll it back. But the funny thing is, all the people who are all the NFT bros, all the people who have .eth in their name or whatever, these people were not even there. They don't even remember. That is so far outside of their experience. And that is so funny to me that this basically the essential history of the Ethereum blockchain is unbeknownst to 90% of the people that use it.
Yeah. Real quick, I looked it up. Yeah, Laura Shin. She has a podcast too that I've listened to.
Unchained, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. Oh yeah, she's great.
Yeah, she is.
Yeah, I mean, you were talking about that a little bit with Brian, and it is kind of, it's the perfect use case of, you know, why companies and a lot of even these DAOs,
they love ETH, man.
Well, I was just going to say that why it's so hard to start things from the very beginning is truly decentralized. And even Yuri, who runs that organization, SuperDAO, is like, most of these DAOs start with some centralized kind of stuff. It's too messy to do. And so, I mean, Ethereum learned that the hard way. Like, right, you have your pie in the sky ideologies, but when shit hit the fan, are you like, we're just going to let this die? Or are we going to intervene because we think it has potential? And so it's like, yeah, you lose some of the decentralization, you know, ideologies, but at least you save the network.
and you know, the Bitcoin bros would said, you should have let it die.
Right. Of course. Oh, they would love if it died.
Well, I was thinking this during the OpenSea hack or contract vulnerability or whatever that turned out to not be a vulnerability. But I was like, how big of an OpenSea vulnerability would it have to be for the Ethereum Foundation to even think about it? And I don't even think it's possible anymore. I think that the nodes are so decentralized now in Ethereum that it wouldn't even be possible. But I was just thinking, like, how big of an NFT hack would it have to be for it to even be like a thing that was voted on in the protocol? Like, would it have to be like every CryptoPunk and every ape was sent to like a stolen address, or would it just be like
Tupla? I think it would have to be like a MetaMask exploit where it was like some kind of wallet or something that the majority of the population used, right? Like if MetaMask had an exploit,
dude, if there was, if there, I can't believe you even just put that out into the universe. But
well, you asked me, you said, no,
but if there was a MetaMask vulnerability, and obviously, you know, we would have to like ask Andy or someone who like really knew about this stuff. Like, I don't even know if this would be possible anymore, but I actually do think that it seems from what people say that Ethereum is decentralized enough that like there wouldn't be anything that anyone could do. Like, even if Vitalik himself was like, no, I want to undo all of these MetaMask vulnerabilities or whatever, I don't think he would have the ability to do it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, it's scary. I mean, the biggest thing about them, we were talking about it on Club Top Shot too, is like, obviously you don't like seeing anything with phishing scams and people losing money in NFTs, but it does serve, the most important thing is like, what can we take away from this? And I definitely feel a little bit more vigilant. I'm moving a little more slowly. I'm not clicking links and verifying and collab landing quite as quickly as I was before. And I think that's it's a good thing, because we are like in NFTs, things move so quickly. And if you don't buy this now and you don't sell this now,
if you don't fast gas, you're fucked.
Yeah. And so I do just think that idea of like moving more slowly, is a very, very good lesson.
It is an extremely good lesson. I mean, I don't know. I would just tell everyone to, and also, guys in Club NG might have made this point, but that the ledger is like a little bit of a false safe haven, because if you sign transactions from the ledger, it functions the same way that a MetaMask does. So, this is, I don't think we've ever talked about this on the show before, but if you are actually rich off of crypto, if you were just one of these people who minted 10 Bored Apes and didn't paper hand them like Soccer Dave or whatever, I would tell you to set up a ledger that interacts with the internet on a laptop once, and then is never connected to the internet again, to have a crypto specific laptop that does not interact with the internet. That I would highly encourage that if you are actually crypto rich.
That's for my most valuable NFTs now that I know I'm not touching. I have a hardware wallet, but that I'm not signing, I'm not doing anything. It's like a true vault. And you know
mint off your ledger.
Right. And maybe you miss a whitelist opportunity or some kind of drop, but it's like, who cares if that's the price of security?
Man, I really hate the whole whitelist thing now. It seems shitty. I don't like, this is something I really don't like about NFTs, is like, just anything where you have to like grind whitelisting. Like, what's the point? What are we doing here? Like,
what's the point of grinding DFS head to heads? You know, it's the same thing.
I'm not saying there should be no grinding involved, but like, make a game people have to play or something. Like, don't have it be like talking in the Discord, right?
Yeah, I mean, you understand the thought process behind whitelists is that you are rewarding your most active community members, and not the rent seekers. The problem is the grinders are rent seekers.
They'll rent seek hard. Yeah, the real grinders will rent seek harder than people who like your shit. I mean, I think that people actually hated this, but I loved the way Mechaverse did theirs. It's just a random raffle.
But then people, that got botted, and people created all kinds of different wallets to get in the raffle.
Yeah. So in theory,
the perfect way to do this would actually be hyper centralized, and it was just the leader of the community going around and arbitrarily giving people whitelists based on what they were contributing in the Discord. Yeah. Like, oh, you're always in here, you're positive, you're helping people with resources. Yeah. Like, now you get it. Like, that would be truly the best way to do it. Even when they say like, get to level 10 in Discord, then everyone's just typing fucking GM in a channel for 2 hours.
I did that once. So I did one grind the whitelist Discord, and I was like, you know what, this is stupid. I'm never doing this again.
I mean, I can't talk shit about the whitelist because one of my did I tell you my story with the NGMI guys, like found basically like 15 ETH for me in the couch cushions that I didn't know I had?
No.
So it was like one random like last fall, it was the small brains on the Treasure ecosystem. They had their whitelist, and it was like, draw small brain on a piece of paper, upload it to Discord, and you'll get put on the whitelist. So I did it just because they were all doing it. And sure. I forgot about it. Oh, and then it went to Mint whitelist. And I saw it was on a different network and that I was going to have to bridge money over to Arbitrum. And I was like, fuck this. Like, it was fun drawing the photo. I'm out. Then on New Year's Eve, I get tagged by NQ and Tom Chambers in the Discord. And they're like, Pete, we just noticed you were on the whitelist and you submitted your wallet, because they like went on a recovery mission from people from the Discord who had done it. And they're like, yeah, the floor for what you can redeem, two smalls and a piece of land, is like 15 ETH right now. I was like, Lauren, we need to leave this New Year's Eve dinner party.
I got to go right now. I'm sorry.
I need to go home and find it. And so like, that is like why these guys are willing to grind the whitelist so hard, is because like, you're going to eat much shit, but every once in a while you're going to get invisible friends, and then it's going to open with like a 12 ETH floor. So like, I get why it is attractive to grind, but man, do you have to do some
toe-licking. I don't mean to criticize anyone grinding. I would be far wealthier if I would commit to the grind.
Yeah.
There's also like a little bit of like, if you actually believe in Bitcoin the way I do, you think you're going to be rich inevitably anyway, which is not helpful in the present, because I could be more present rich if I was willing to grind these NFT things harder. But I'm just like, whatever. When I'm 60, I'm going to be, an oligarch or whatever anyway, because I think of Bitcoin is going to go to X, Y, or Z, and it's probably bad. It's probably why all the Club AMG my bros, they're like, bro, Bitcoin sucks.
I feel like I kind of middle it. Like, I don't go true grinder, but if there's really low hanging fruit, or I've noticed too, like if you hold certain NFTs, like those tend to get whitelisted more than others. So like, I have one of those lemon heads and I just have one of them, but I like keep getting on whitelists just because you own that one thing. So I'll take the second to go collab land for that. But yeah, no, I mean, I've never done the true whitelist grind where you're just chatting in a random Discord trying to get elevated. Like, I was like, that's a line that I have to draw it at.
Yeah. All right. You got anything else?
No, man. A week from today, I will be on a plane and definitely looking forward to unplugging even more so.
Oh, can't wait. I have a golf trip in like 2 months where I'll be out for 4 days, and I am just, it's going to be, the NFL draft will be done. I'll be able to be drafting best ball teams on the 18th green, which is what it's really all about.
When Davis Matic bachelor party.
That's it. That we're just taking, we're just doing.
You're not, I didn't get invited trip to the bachelor party.
You want to come? You are, we have a huge, like a 13 room house.
When is it? I'm more offended that I didn't get, how was I getting invited to the wedding that I can't go to, but not to the bachelor party, which I could potentially go to?
It's the first weekend in May.
Okay. Well, keep me posted.
Yeah. It might be a little hard for you to get to. Like, there's probably not an airport super close to it. Like, you probably have to rent a car.
Wait, where is it?
Lake of the Ozarks.
Oh, dude. I want to check out the Ozarks. God damn it. It's, Davis, give me a proper invite.
I will. I mean, yeah, you're more than welcome.
Well, I feel bad that I can't go to your wedding, but I would definitely go to the bachelor party.
Well, it's all right. You have to be there. I told Zakarian that. I did team holdo with him the other morning, and I was like, you're a fucking asshole. You're the reason Pete can't come to my wedding, bro.
I know. You two both tell me the wedding's on the same day. I'm like, God damn it. So yes, I'm in for the bachelor party.
Beautiful. All right. Well, yeah, you're in. You're invited. I'll have my best man send you all the information you need.
Do we have any other online friends coming, or is this all Davis IRL friends?
All Davis IRL friends.
We should get Karain. Karain? To come to.
Does Karain like to golf?
Actually, I don't know.
I mean, we're not just golfing. Like, we'll be hanging out.
I really, I don't mean to hijack it, but we also need to invite Laird. I'm taking over the guest list for your bachelor party.
I mean, so that's funny you say that, because I was going to invite Laird, but I was like, he doesn't want to come.
He will.
Like, I was going to invite Laird to the wedding, but I was like, he also doesn't want to come to that. And also, he'll be at training camp.
He'll come golf in the Ozarks. It sounds like a blast.
My dude, my IRL buddies would be like, they would lose their minds if Laird came.
All right, there we go. Well, we're gonna make this happen. Let's fire up the. I'll get my Apple burner phone and we'll discuss logistics.
Okay. Wow, sounds amazing. All right, everyone, thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Nike, Walmart, and Zappos. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers. And Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.